Hello, everybody. This is Craig D. Lindsay, a.k.a. Uncle Krizzle, a.k.a. Black Larry David, a.k.a. Anastasia Beaverhausen, a.k.a. Tavis Not-So-Smiley, a.k.a. Cranky Charlie Rose, a.k.a. whatever the hell you want to call me. And welcome to another fun edition of Motherfuckers I Know, the podcast where I talk to motherfuckers I know, just to remind myself, as always, that I know, motherfuckers. And for today's Krizzlecast, we're talking to somebody from my old stomping grounds of Texas. Been a freelance writer and critic for quite a while now. he's written for various sites like rockcritics.com, The House Next Door, and IndieWire. He's also written and co-produced video essays for Museum of the Moving Image, the L Magazine, and Press Play. And we're just gonna chop it up for a while or so. So let me see if I get Aaron Aradilis.
Yes, Aaron Aradilis.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm here. Good to finally be on the show. I'm flattered that I get to be amongst the ranks, including Soul Brother Number One, Odie Henderson, now in his company. So.
Yeah. Well, just like it's a pleasure to have you on the Krizzlecast here. You know, it's funny. Before I got on the horn with you, I was wrapped up in one of your old pieces for rockcritics.com. Because for those who don't know that site, that's where writers talk to other rock critics, hence the name rockcritics.com. But it's funny, when you started writing for that site, you took a different direction and actually started reviewing film critics. Interviewing film critics, shall I say. People like Owen Gleiberman and Glenn Kenny and Lisa Schwarzbaum. And one I particularly enjoyed was talking with David Edelstein, who has written for the Village Voice and Slate and other sites. And so just trying to see how do you get started into going over to that site and saying, hey, I want to interview film critics instead of just talking about rock critics.
Well, I've always been enamored with film critics, movie critics, however you want to call it, and but just criticism in general. Uh-huh. And so I always, if I like a critic's writing, in no matter what field it is, music, film, obviously, TV, whatever, books, I go to that person's, I trust that person's byline. And it's not so much that I'm in agreement with that, that critic, it's just that I like their writing so much that even when I'm in disagreement, that, you know, I like to know what they're thinking of whatever they're reviewing. And so I've always been that way with film criticism in particular and rock criticism. And so I stumbled upon that site, I guess, a few months prior to my first interview, and I had just spent days, you know, and I was supposed to be studying. I was in college at the time, and I could have been studying, but I would just spend hours, you know, days upon days, reading their archives of all these in-depth back and forth with rock critics, and I just liked it, and I reached out. This would be cool for movie critics. I actually looked. I go, well, has someone done this for movie critics? Is there a moviecritics.com where it's, you know, interviewed like this? And you would find an occasional, you know, brief interview here or there. But other than, like, you know, maybe a collection of Pauline Kael interviews or some Saris interviews, you didn't get any interviews with, you know, the critics of the day at that time. And so I reached out to the editor of rockcritic.com and said, hey, I love this site. Would you be interested in doing this for movie critics also on it, on the site, you know, movie critics, in-depth interviews? And so he jumped into this idea, and there's a gentleman by the name of Scott Woods. Uh-huh. Gave me my first break. And you gotta understand, this is like type of pop up, and it started really to consolidate, but it was still kind of a wild, wild west sort of in certain areas. And so this idea that I'll just send someone an email and said, hey, I have an idea, are you interested? You know, that was still kind of, you know, new. And also on my end, you know, this is my first ever foray into journalism of any kind. I'm an English major. And so, you know, without having met me, you know, they get this email like, well, I don't know this person, can I trust them? But Scott Woods was generous enough, said, yeah, if you can do it, go ahead. And to be honest, the whole reason I started doing that series of interviews is I wanted to meet, in some capacity, Owen Dwyerman of Entertainment Weekly, EW. He is, and was, and is my favorite film critic, even to this day. I love his writing. I don't always agree with him, but I just love the way he manages in that constricted space of a periodical like EW, manages to turn a phrase and just really has a way of seeing things. And really, one of the few critics can cut through all the hype and so forth. And so I was like, this would be a guy I'd want to talk to. And I thought this would be the best way. This would be my excuse to meet Owen Dwyerman. And so that was the first one I pitched. And so it was all a matter of like, will someone, you know, open the door to the next one? So Scott Woods at rockcritics.com said I can do an interview. Okay, now it's a matter, okay, tonight, how do I get in touch with Owen Dwyerman? They're like, well, we interviewed Ken Tucker, who was a rock critic, still is a rock critic, and still is a rock critic for Fresh Air. They're like, well, we interviewed him a couple of years ago. Maybe we can ask him to get Owen's email. So I send an email to Ken Tucker. You know, once again, he doesn't know who I am. And he forwards me Owen's work email. Great. So now I send an interview request to Owen Dwyerman, who obviously doesn't know who I am, and I have no clips, as it were. I have nothing else to show for. It's just this idea. And it's just a matter of waiting to see if he will even say yes. And luckily he did. And they're all email interviews. They're back and forth. And the way I would do it is I would come up with questions. I'd send them off. They would answer them. And if there was any follow-ups, I would send those off and so forth. And it's a real collaborative experience. So Owen Dwyerman and Scott Woods are the two biggies who got me my first break in journalism. And it was such a hit and such a good experience that I just carried on, and I just built up this kind of weird network through the internet, through email, of I was the person that interviewed movie critics, and they liked the questions I asked, and it just went on from there.
Well, I mean, was there often, I noticed that there is kind of like this, I don't know if you call it a formula that you have when you interviewed a lot of these critics. I mean, the first question was often, what was the first movie-going experience that you remember leaving a lasting impression on you? I mean, was it just like things that you knew that you was wanted to get out of them, and just you had this set of questions that you needed to ask them, or like was there any? I mean, was there like a guy
that
you had?
It all stems from a ton of research I would do, because
yeah,
the critics I interviewed, you know, uh-huh, Owen Dwyerman, Jamie Bernard, David Edelstein, uh-huh, Glenn Kinney, Janet Maslin, Lisa Schwarzbaum, Mike Clark of USA Today, all these critics I followed and I read. And when I read, I knew a good chunk of their reviews. And
yeah,
so I knew a little bit, you know, so if you read someone's reviews over a long period of time, you know, they're also personal. They can also be very personal, so you glean certain tidbits here and there.
Yeah.
And so there were certain questions that I always did ask every one of them, because even as myself, as, you know, a wannabe burgeoning film critic, these were kind of the touchstones of, if you legitimate, you know, professional critics. So, you know, what was your first movie going experience that left an impression on you? And I'd always ask about the, you know, what impact did the Kale Sarah schools of criticism have on you? And then also, depending on, you know, where to go to college, you know, what was that formative experience like? And then also, because I knew their work, there were certain trends, there's certain, either you could say there's trends or blind spots or certain, you know, motifs that would run through their reviews. So I would ask about those. There's certain things that they'd always recall in their reviews throughout their reviews. And then also at the end, I would ask them what they thought of the state of criticism at that time. And remember, so this is all 04 going into 05. And these were, you know, it's funny, if you look at the roster of those critics, only a couple of them are still in print. They're either out of the business because of all the downsides in the film critics' job, or they've gone online, like Glenn Kinney is now on MSN Movies, and David Edelstein, who is in print and online at, you know, New York Magazine. Owens is now the last man standing at EW. But Janet Maslin no longer reviews movies. She's a book critic. You know, Lisa Schwartzbaum just left. Mike Clark and Jamie Bernard are no longer in print. Mike Clark now, he has a home video column on Home Media Magazine, but he's not at USA Today anymore. So I didn't have time, but I was getting a lot of these critics on the record while they were, you know, while criticism was still vital, you know. Yeah. You know, there wasn't this plethora of blogs and sites. You know, now anyone can have a blog and, you know, write their review. You know, the so-called democracy of the internet has done that. And while that is freeing and that is interesting, there's been a lot of great voices, there's also a lot of voices who really shouldn't be writing. And so just, I wanted to talk to these critics who had history and they have authority. I feel they have an authority on the subject matter. So, it turned out I got a lot of them on the record. And so we're going on 10 years now since I did that series of interviews. But now there's, you know, and they were, you know, what the critics were in the 60s and 70s, you know, the Kales, the McDonalds, you know, the John Simon and the Andrew Sarris's and the Molly Haskell's, and these are all great critics. I love him. I'm friendly with Molly Haskell. You know, she's still one of my all-time favorite critics. But here, to me, what I was doing with these reviews, these were kind of, this was that next guard of those veterans. You know, Owen and Lisa. And then, you know, even guys I didn't get to interview, like David Denby, you know, and, you know, so many others. And now we're in the midst of a next generation coming about, and it's a lot of internet critics, but there's still a great generation of critics. I mean, Keith Hewlett and Vadim Rizov and Odie, these are three of the, you know, some of the, I consider some of the best, you know. So hopefully in another, you know, 15, 20 years, maybe someone will want to do a series of interviews with, you know, Keith and, you know, Vadim and see what, you know, what it's like. Because now, obviously, critics are becoming much younger. You know, there was this whole kind of, you know, it's interesting, the Boston Phoenix just closed. And a couple of the critics that I interviewed, they started the Boston Phoenix in the 80s. And the Boston Phoenix in the 80s was kind of like a, you know, the farm team, you know, Owen and Edelstein and Charlie Taylor and Lisa with the real paper. And so now they're the biggie, you know, they're in the mainstream. And so, you know, there was this kind of, tier system going on. Now, with the internet, there's not so much of a tier system, I don't think, or at least not the same kind of tier system. So, you know, guys like, you know, Keith and Eric Cohn and all of these, you know, great critics, they're starting off in their, you know, in their 20s, and so really building up a real body of work. And of course, there are some critics who like to snipe at these younger ones saying, it's a learning process. You learn, opinions you have on a movie in your 20s, I'll be amazed if you still have that opinion in your 40s, just because life experiences either enhance or diminish whatever you thought in your 20s. So it'll be interesting to see the evolution of a lot of the current pop critics.
Well, yeah, that's often a feeling I have whenever, especially as a film critic, because I've talked about this with other film critics, and it's kind of funny because, what you're doing, what you did then for RockCritics.com is kind of what I've been doing on this podcast, talking to a lot of film critics and film writers I admire, and just getting, into their lives as critics, and getting to what got them to, at this point of being a film critic, just trying to get into their lives, and just, was there anything that you found most revealing about any of the people you interviewed? I mean, any things that took you by surprise?
Took me by surprise. It was just the way that a lot of them had seen. I wound up meeting most of them in person. I haven't met Chad Maslin or Lisa Schwartzbaum, unfortunately. Still would love to meet those two lovely ladies. But I've met everyone else, or I've talked to them extensively on the phone privately, and they're all real close friends. Owen Liverman is one of my best friends now, and what surprised me when I talked to them is that it turns out a lot of them, the vast majority of them, they talk in the same manner that they write, and so their writing is an extension in a lot of ways of the kind of conversations you would have with them. So, I've had dinner with David Edelstein, and so he talks, if you read his interview, he talks in the same manner, which is he's very thoughtful and deliberate in his word choices. And where Glenn Kinney, I've hung out with him, and he is a little he can go on and on about a certain topic and have just an encyclopedic knowledge of it, but he can also kind of be a free associating at the same time. So it was interesting that they to find out that they talk in the same manner that they write most of the time. So that was an interesting thing that I found out, and I find that true of most critics. Critics, the way they write is generally the way they talk. So if you respond to a critic's voice on the page, you're going to respond to them in person. So take that what you will. I mean, I don't say that as an exclusive. So who knows? Maybe Rex Reed is actually an intelligent, thoughtful person. But if you just go by his writing, you probably wouldn't want to share a cab with him.
Well, as you say, you're an English major at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
Right. English major, minor in linguistics, with an emphasis on African-American linguistics, believe it or not.
African-American linguistics. Okay, wait, let's talk about that real briefly. Why did you want to make an emphasis on African-American linguistics in your minor?
It's not so much, it just turned out that the amount of credits that I needed for a minor, and it turned out that like half of that, I wound up studying African American linguistics. So, I mean, my minor is overall linguistics, but I concentrated on African American linguistics because I just thought that was interesting. I was fascinated with it. I've always been fascinated, fascinated with African American pop culture. I just thought, and I knew a lot about African American pop culture, and so I just thought, this would be something that I could really, really slide into. It's far more far more topical and interesting African American linguist that's in current and modern than, say, if you were to do an emphasis on, you know, Norse English. You know, it's not, it's, that's a little dry. And so, yeah, African American linguistics. So, yeah, I mean, so I had a professor, and oddly enough, all I learned from African American linguistics, I had to learn on my own, because I had this, it was the single worst professor I ever had in all of my college years. She was a terrible, terrible woman. Everything I learned on my own about African American linguistics.
Well, what made this person so particularly terrible?
This was undergraduate. This was an undergraduate class, and she had just the first of. I went off my last semester of college. You know, so I was graduating. I needed this class to graduate. I had all my credits. I had like two classes I had to take. This one and another elective. So I'm just like sailing, right? I'm just like, okay, I just got like 6 hours I gotta take, and I'm walking the stage. Well, so my last semester was her first semester teaching. And it was an undergraduate class, and the vast majority, there's only like maybe 15, 20 of us in this class, and a bunch of us needed this class to graduate. I needed it for my minor, a lot of other people just needed this for an elective. Well, she took it upon herself to treat it like a graduate course. So we never knew where we stood, grade-wise. So there was a midterm, and, you know, a lot of us didn't pass it. And so it was right before the drop period. But, you know, we didn't know what our grade was, and we couldn't drop, and so we were just stuck. She didn't know how to instruct. She was just, you know, you would ask her a question, and she'd be kind of like, well, what do you think? And like, well, we think this. Well, we'll make an argument for that. So there is no concrete learning, really, in that class from the instructor. Also, like I said, this was her first semester, so she was moving from, I think, Georgia down here. So, I mean, she was just unprofessional. Her cell phone would ring all the time in class, and she would stop class to answer her cell phone because, I guess, the movers were arriving at her house. So, I mean, she was just an evil, evil woman. And plus, I'm disabled, and so I need, like, special, you know, I need, you know, ADA compliance. I need certain, you know, adaptations that teacher has to make, and she refused to make them. She refused. And I didn't have the time or the luxury to, like, go to the chair or the English department to plead my case. So I just had to bear down and, you know, just deal with it and rush through. So she was an evil, evil woman. And plus, I think she was also confused. Psychologically, she was an African American woman, but she was married to a white man. So, like, you know, just on that level, I think she was in denial of a lot of things. She should not have been taking African American linguistics.
Okay, so it's like she's an African American woman and married to a white man, and that made her confused psychologically.
That's how vicious the class deteriorated. Towards the end of the semester, you know, we're like, you know, she just seemed confused. I mean, so, you know, I mean, it just got pretty, there was a lot of vitriol in that class towards her. You know, she would come in every Monday, and just raving about the previous night's Boston Legal and how much she had a huge crush growing up on William Shatner. And I wish I was making this up, but I swear to God, I'm not making any of this up. She had a huge crush on William Shatner growing up, and so she just loved Boston Legal, with William Shatner, and so forth. And so, in the example, you know, she would bring in certain things, you know, she would bring in, like, comedy clips, African-American comedians, to kind of demonstrate some of the things she was trying to make. And so, when you hear that, you're like, oh, okay. You know, you're thinking maybe Richard Pryor or Dave Chappelle, you know, some of the more cutting-edge comedians who really, or Chris Rock, who really, you know, use language and stretch the possibility of language. You know, she bring in, you know, her favorite comic was Steve Harvey. That's who she would bring in clips from. Was, you know, from the Steve Harvey show. And no disrespect to Steve Harvey, he's hilarious, but, you know, was not in my top five when it comes to African-American linguistics. So
all the way around, this was just a fucked up class.
Like I said, luckily I had a good enough working knowledge just on my own reading of African-American linguistics. So, and needless to say, I was one of maybe three or four people of the entire class of any kind of color, me being Mexican-American. The rest of the class was white. So, there was a sense of, like, of deference, like, well, should I really challenge her? And I didn't give a shit. This was my last semester. I was going to go out, you know, James Cagney and White Heat. You know, just because it was an African-American professor and it was African-American linguistics, you know, I wasn't going to defer to her and say, oh, obviously you know more than me about this. You know, that was bullshit. On this one, I actually knew more than her in certain aspects. So, yeah. So I remember, I'll tell you a funny story. I remember we were talking about African-American music on different, you know, genre of music and how you can tell between when a given genre of music is being performed by an African-American singer versus a white singer. You know, what are the telltale signs of that? And, you know, so, like, she played a couple of country songs. So, you know, you had, you know, a couple of white boys country, and then you'd have, you know, some African-American country. And, you know, so, you know, what's the difference? Or with blues, you know, you have some white boy blues, and then you have Robert Johnson, you know, you play a Robert Johnson song. You know, what's the difference between Robert Johnson and a white person playing similar blues at the same time? And, you know, we would talk about, well, there's just kind of a feeling, there's a little rawness, there's an edge to it, and, you know, it's just, you can kind of tell in certain things. And so I remember I broke up the class, and this was the one time she even remotely acknowledged me as being halfway smart, because we went through music, so then we started going to rock and to soul, you know, reggae and funk. I said, well, now, I go, the way you can tell is, you know, as we're getting into, like, funk and reggae, I go, well, it has to have a horn section. And she's like, excuse me? I was like, yeah. I go, if it's white people doing reggae or funk, it doesn't have a horn section. So this was the one. So my quoting of a Dave Chappelle sketch that everyone got but her, that was, like, my knowledge that, you know, that was something that she, like, gave me credit for. So I was kind of proud of that. Of that, you know, the big difference is the horn section in African American music. Which I sort of stand by.
Oh, alright, yes, yes. It's funny because we're just talking about this one class and everything. Because it is kind of interesting how just like...
Well, I'll tell you what, here's the thing. And so I was at the time in
Well, wait, 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 you know, wait, so, can I just say, like, we're just, it's funny because, you know, and this is one of the reasons why I do this show, is to get into things and talking with people and that people may not have known about a particular person, because just, like, I didn't know we were going to get into talking about this experience, this rather harrowing experience that you had with this instructor, this African-American linguistics class. And it's such an interesting, fascinating thing. Just, like, we got other things to talk about, because I know a lot about you, but at the same time, this is just, I kind of want to know more about all this.
Well, I tell you, well, here's my big thing. So she claimed to be, you know, really in, you know, I mean, this was her field, African-American linguistics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she told a story why she got into this field. And she said she got into this field because she remembered as a kid how they would make most important directorial debut of that decade. So I love everything about it. I think it's an amazing piece of filmmaking. And, you know, talk about dialects and Southern dialect. You know, it's got this whole confluence of not only Southern dialect, Southern African American dialect, but hip hop dialect, and then Southern hip hop dialect, and it's all just swirling about. So I'd ask this one, hey, have you seen Hustle and Flow? What about that film? You know, what about the way, you know, the characters talk and then the rhyme schemes and so forth? And she's like, no, she goes, what is that? I go, Hustle and Flow. I tell her, she's like, no, I don't know that one. I was like, well, you should check that out. And so she's like, never seen Hustle and Flow, let alone heard of it. So right there, that was like a red flag early on. I was like, okay, you're supposedly one of the leading experts on African American linguistics, and you're staying current, and you don't know a thing about Hustle and Flow. Now, obviously, some people can say, well, that's just anecdotal. But, it might be anecdotal, but, you know, this is probably why you're still bringing in Steve Harvey clips, because, you know, the original Kings of Comedy was like, you know, at this time was like 7 years old, and you're not bringing in, you know, Chappelle's Show or Hustle and Flow. So, it's just one of those red flags that goes up in your mind, like, oh, maybe they're not as intuitive as I thought they were.
Well, I don't know how old this person was, but, like, sometimes, you know, especially when you're dealing with people who are so-called experts, one of the obstacles they have to deal when you deal with a person like that is that they have their own idea or perspective of whatever field they're experts in, you know, that's their thing. So they have an idea of what their field is, and unfortunately it kind of stops at a certain point. And then you can say that about you know, critics in general, because, you know, of course, you know, there are critics who are, especially I found, you know, living around here, just not even film critics, but just film enthusiasts. I mean, they have their own spot. They have their own pocket. I mean, they're into these kind of films and these sort of, you know, there are people who, I know somebody who won't see any film or any TV show that has some who has violence in it. You know, she is very against seeing anything violent in a movie, even if it's something like No Country for Old Men or There Will Be Blood. You know, she didn't see any of that, and you know they just stay in their own, you know, wheelhouse, their own part of the whole part of the thing. So I mean, you have to deal with people like that, and unfortunately, you know, you had to deal with that in this class, which apparently is one of the most memorable experiences in your academic career.
It is a scarring class. I mean, there's no Hustle and Flow, there's no Chappelle Show. Remember, this is like 07, so like The Wire and The Shield are like still in full effect. So like, you know, talk about some African American dialects going on in the culture. Crunk was all the rage still at the time. Kanye was still being kind of figured out by a lot of the mainstream. You know, Gold Digger was big, but that's about it. He hadn't gotten angrier than he is now. So she was just kind of, I love the subject. I love what I learned on my own. Hated the class. I still use what I learned on my own to this day. It's one of the reasons why I so admire Django Unchained, because of different voices in that. In that film, which is kind of spectacular. Some of the voices in there.
How do you pass this whole class? That's basically like everything like this woman taught in is just a bad class, and not a lot of people are getting anything out of it. How'd you pass?
I got through it. I got a C. I don't know how it was. I mean, it was one of those deals. The graduation ceremony was like before final grades got posted. But, you know, I walked the stage, I graduated, and got my grades, I got a C. Don't know, you know, I didn't ask what she thought of what my final paper was, blah, 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 you know, didn't care. Just give me the C, and we'll call it a day. Well, see, the thing was, I think she got scared because it got so bad with her, with that class. The entire class, all 20 of us or whatever, how many of us, maybe a little more, we actually united and unionized and filed a complaint with the chair against her. And this was her first, like I said, this was her first semester teaching. So a whole class, you know, basically unites to file a complaint with the chair of the English department. That is unheard of. I found out later that, you know, you can go to those websites where, you know, rateyourprofessor.com kind of thing. Mm. So I remember I punched in her name, and, like, from wherever she, whatever previous university she'd come from, she'd also gotten a lot of bad student reviews, you know, and so forth. And, but she had all the credentials. So she's kind of like, she was kind of like one of these, draft picks you see in the NFL or the NBA. Like, they're constantly being traded, even though on paper they're like, oh great, they're a really good defender, they really know how to rebound, or they got good stats, but when you get them, you know, they got good stats, but you know, no one stops to wonder, well, why have they been on 5 teams in 6 seasons? You know, no one stops to wonder, well, what's their personality like, and so forth. You know, so she was one of these professors where she looked great on paper, but no one bothered to ask, well, what is her, you know, what are her review, you know, her conduct reviews, or, you know, so forth. And they've just been, you know, she's just been terrible. And I was friends with other professors in that department, you know, close friends, where, you know, even after I graduated, I would still talk to them on the phone, and I would ask them about this lady, and they're like, oh, she's terrible, no one likes her. So, you know, so I felt vindicated in that way, that, you know, it wasn't my imagination. She was a terrible person. She still is. I think she still teaches there.
Wow.
So I've yet to run... God does exist, because I've yet to run into her since then. Because I always told myself, if I ever did run into her, you know, on the street, as it were, I would probably punch her.
You go that way. You go that route. You'd actually inflict bodily harm on a female. Is that bad?
On this one. You know, honestly, I mean, no. I probably would not punch her, but I would just unload on her and just humiliate her verbally in public wherever I saw her. So, I would do that. I would do that. And so, proof that there is a God is that I've yet to run into her since then. So that tells me God doesn't want me to meet her again.
Wow, that's an amazing story, sir. It kind of it's almost like being disoriented and trying to figure out what to say next, because I wanted to get into, like, how'd you... You know, I want to transition into your career
of
writing, and trying to figure out how you go from that route to that. Especially,
I'll tell you this. This is how we can segue into critics. In that, like I said, you know, just because this woman was like I said, African American, and so she, you know, teaching a class in African American linguistics. Like I said, a lot of the students, there was a little bit of trepidation or timidness, because they're like, oh, well, she must know what she's talking about, you know, and, you know, a lot of the students were like, well, I'm white, so, I'll just defer to her, and I get called bullshit on that. I may not be African-American, but that doesn't mean, you know, I'm not going to defer to you either, especially if I think you're full of shit. So I'll just say that, you know, that experience emboldened me in a critical way, in that even with critics, certain critics who feel that they're an authority figure on something, or feel that they're right on something, and that I will call them out, like, no,
Well, I'm pretty sure I know which one you're referring to, and I've actually spoken to, I believe I've actually spoken about him to several other critics on his podcast. And, yes, by the way, I love how you're being discreet with a lot of names for this. I kind of appreciate that. But,
I've never met him. I have spoken to him on the phone. I've had three extended conversations with him on the phone, and they were generally friendly. They were friendly conversations.
Yeah.
But I chose to stop talking after a certain, a certain situation with a filmmaker happened, and I just said, no, I really don't need to talk to this person anymore.
Yeah. I'm assuming you mean the Noah Baumbach situation.
Yeah. When I actually spoke to the critic like literally a couple, like 10 days before that story broke, and you know it was a friendly conversation. So when that story broke, and I was following it, and I was like, you know, I guess you don't need to talk to this person anymore because this is just this behavior just crosses the line.
Yeah. Well, getting back to you as a writer and a critic, and then also as a video essayist, I've seen a lot of the stuff you did with Matt Zoller's sites over at Press Play. But also, I wanted to discuss, you mentioned, thankfully you mentioned it first about being disabled. I believe the term is you are legally blind?
Yes, I'm legally blind. Legally impaired, legally blind. The capsule version of it, I was born totally blind with glaucoma. My eyes were completely white. So I was born totally blind, had my first surgery, I think at either 6 weeks or 8 weeks old, around there. By the time I was 10 or 12, I had about 40 to 50 surgeries. So as it is, I can now see out of my left eye, about 3 to 5 feet, pretty 3 to 5 feet out of my left eye, I think so. So when I go to the movies, I usually sit in the third row, somewhere between the first to sixth row, between one to six rows is where I'll sit, depending on how big the screen is, or how wide, or how far up the seats are, and so forth. So I can usually make out what's going on the screen at that space. Foreign films obviously are a little tricky. I do go see foreign films with my dad. So we usually go in the middle of the week, like a Tuesday or Wednesday, when we know that there's not going to be a lot of people in the theater, maybe only a couple people in the back, and he will whisper very softly the subtitles. So like that's how I saw Holy Motor and Amore last year, and Amore made my top 10 list. So that's how that goes. So like, the instance I always point out is like, in Casablanca, Humphrey Bogart's at the train station, he gets a letter from Ingrid Bergman saying, sorry, but I'm ditching you, basically. Well, back in the day, they would just do a freeze, they would just hold on the letter for like 5 minutes so the audience could read it. I couldn't read the letter. But, starting with, War Games? Starting with War Games is basically when they started, like, either they had a computer voice read what was being on the screen, or, oddly enough, the person who was typing felt compelled to talk out loud. Whatever they were typing. Now, while that may not be realistic, it does help me quite a bit, and which is why I still have a hold a special place in my heart for Jumping Jack Flash with Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh yeah, they brought in Jonathan Pryce to actually voice Jumping Jack Flash, to make sure get everything that the dude says and everything. In preparing for this stuff like this, because I'm sure, I don't know if you get this often with a lot of people, just like how do you even go about doing this line of work, you know, with the condition that you have. I mean, you kind of explain it, just how you go about doing it, but it's still, like, even not only just as a film critic, as the person who goes to see movies a lot and write about them, as well as, you know, you work on video essays, and of course, like, you know, when you work on video essays, you really have to be, you know, you really have to look at a lot of things and make sure, you know, you're down everything. So.
On the video essay part, I would write, a lot of the times, I would write the scripts, the narration,
mm-hmm.
and I would also write what I thought, my suggestions would be also, you know, okay, this line of the narration should be followed by this clip, and so forth. So that's what I would write. And then, either Matt, or his brother Rich, or Stephen Santos, or Dave Bunting, you know, these are the guys who are actually doing the editing. And so they would take my suggestions, and either, you know, they would try it, or they would improve on it, you know, and do their own thing. And then, you know, of course, they would send it to me, like, okay, here's our edit. So I'd look at the edit, and be like, okay, that works, that doesn't work, you know, or I would, you know, I'd give my notes, and it'd be a collaborative thing. So that's usually how it worked. I mean, it worked that way on the series for the L magazine. I mean, the scripts for the L magazine series that me and Matt did on the dueling summers of 84 and 89. Mm-hmm. I mean, those scripts were like 10 pages long. And a lot of that, you know, I knew what clips were going to be. And me and Matt would have these conversations like, okay, well, we should cut to this scene. He'd be like, yeah, we'll cut to this scene. And so we just go back and forth. And probably the script or video essay I'm most proudest of, I don't know, it's a toss-up. I mean, I love the dueling summers that we did for the L magazine.
Uh-huh.
I would say the moving image stuff, I would think we did the series on the opening credits of David Fincher.
Uh-huh.
That was my idea. You know, Social Network was coming out, and I called up Matt one day and said, hey, I got an idea for a video essay series. This was like real crunch time. And I was like, and, you know, we won't need narration. So that took a big part of it. Like, okay, what is that? I go, title sequences of David Fincher. I go, they'll be short. We just do the title sequences. And he's like, okay. So the Zodiac one is probably my favorite, which was my favorite film of that decade. And the last video essay I just did was for this Cruel Summer series I did last year, on Batman, the impact, the legacy of Tim Burton's Batman. That one, I think, is just remarkable. So, you know, a lot of the video essays, when you see it, when it finally goes up, you know, it's close to what you had in your mind, but obviously for certain, you know, because of time or whatever, you're like, well, you know, this is almost what I had, but this is, you know, close enough. The Batman video essay series, that is exactly how I had it in my head. There's the Rich Sites, and with his Matt's brother, and Kevin B. Lee really helped me on that one. They really did amazing jobs on that. So that one was, like, you know, I couldn't improve on that one, on the Batman one. That one is perfect.
Well, yeah, so, you did do those as well. You also did this internet radio show, Back by Midnight.
Yes, I did that for about, I guess, a year and a half, a year and a half and change. That was probably, I mean, that was a lot of hard work, very time-consuming. I enjoyed it most of the time. So I had some great interviews, I had some great times on there. I stopped just because of the time consuming. It was taken away from my writing. I really wanted to write more and do other things. And also, when I started that, the whole idea of podcasts that focused on home entertainment were still, you know, coming about. And so, you know, I was getting, like, I would get 20-minute know, I had, you know, William Friedkin for like over 30 minutes, you know, and some other people. But as more and more of like home entertainment podcasting shows popped up, it once again became regimented. You know, kind of like your, you know, with theatrical movies with the press junket, you know, you get 6 minutes with the talent, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so I started not getting the 20-minute, 30-minute interview time. You know, they're like, okay, he's going to be doing phone calls all day for 2 days. Got you for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And so there was no real letting the interview, you know, grow and giving it some breathing room. And so it was starting to become kind of canned. And so I just stopped after a while. And plus, you know, and also I think a lot of the managers or agents, the publicists, they really started to get wise to all these podcasts and so forth of their talent, and you know, they're not getting paid for their time. So they were being you started getting a lot of no's as opposed to, well, maybe, or yeah, I'll forward this along. So after a while you just started getting no. So it just started to become a real grind. So, but I mean, I did enjoy it. Two shows on The Sopranos, 3 shows on The Wire, 3 shows on Deadwood. Those are kind of like my highlights, if you will. And then the Friedkin show was a big brouhaha at the time. And so yeah.
I believe at some point you managed to interview Molly Haskell.
Yes, I've interviewed her. I did interview her, and I had met her in person back in like the spring of '08 when I went. I was at this New York Times sponsored workshop for film critics and feature writing, and so her and Andrew Saris came in and spoke to it. There was like I forget how many of us, 9, 10. So you know, that's where I first met Kevin Lee, and I met Eric Cohn, I met Karina Longworth, Cynthia Fuchs, Jack Kurian, Eric Cohn at the time, he was freelance. He was writing for Scream.com. He wasn't, the IndieWire critic. He was like the coolest, nicest guy, there. Same with Kevin Lee. Kevin was awesome. He was just, you know, real, I mean, he knew his shit. And so, he was a cool guy to hang with. Karina, nice, very nice, I liked her. She's a little, obviously a little guarded, and that's just Karina being Karina. So Molly and Andrew came in and they spoke to us and signed our books. I have an Andrew Saris book signed by Andy, if you will, and Molly. And the great story of Molly Haskell. So we had this like 90-minute conversation, and then we're all going to leave the museum. This is at the Museum of the Moving Image. And then we're going to walk a block down to this Greek restaurant and have dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just going to go for the reception because I had some other plans. So, Andrew decided, because of his age at the time, he took the car. They drove him to the restaurant, which was a couple blocks down, but Molly decided to walk. And so she decided to be, she offered to be my sighted guide. So she walked with me to the restaurant. So an impromptu sighted guide walking me down the sidewalk. So that was really cool. She was still in the process of finishing her Gone with the Wind book. So we were talking about that as we walked. So yeah, so for a good 10 minutes, Molly Haskell was my sighted guide. So that was kind of the highlight of the whole trip.
I believe you passed that anecdote over to Matt when Andrew Saris passed away, and he had that remembering.
Yeah, tribute to him. That's my biggest regret. I had spoken to Molly a couple of times about doing some kind of extensive interview with Andrew.
Yeah.
Of some sort. With Andrew Saris. I wanted to get his story on the record.
Yeah.
And I had talked that I didn't get the Andy and Molly story on the record.
Yeah.
So that's a big regret.
But, yeah, I was just saying that that anecdote can be found, like, on the Remembering Andrew Saris post that Matt did for Press Play. I did something else about. Yeah, I did this odd thing about how I thought that that Saris and Rex Reed over the New York Observer is kind of like the same relationship Matt had with the critic, the contrarian critic who shall not be named, over at the New York Press.
The Voldemort critic.
But we both put something in that that piece. And
it's great stuff.
Yeah, but
go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying how you're down there and you still live in San Antonio, right?
Yeah, I still live in San Antonio.
And just it kind of just I miss I'm from Houston originally. And
Houston's one of those cities you can drive for 45 minutes and still be in Houston.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just like it's kind of weird going from Houston to Raleigh, North Carolina, where I am now, because it's Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, it's like all these spots, and just it feels so distant and apart from each other, but it's kind of the same thing with Houston, except it's all just one spot, and it's just the loop and everything, and just like it's difficult to explain, but since you're down there in Texas, and just kind of makes me wonder how just being who you are in that part of the country. How does that fare? I mean, especially because, like, the South by Southwest just happened. And I know, did you go to that?
No, I didn't go to that. I know people who do go to it and cover it, and, I mean, it just sounds like hell, from what I've heard. It's just like, I think 300,000 people were at the last one, which is, and if you've ever been to the city of Austin, 300,000 people concentrated over just, a couple of blocks where usually South by Southwest is held. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just total gridlock. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing appealing about that. And so, I guess it's kind of what Park City goes through once a year with the Sundance.
Yeah.
But, at least they've kind of, they seem to have some kind of working infrastructure in Park City, where Austin doesn't seem to have an infrastructure yet in place to handle the total chaos of South by Southwest. So I don't go to it. I mean, I do travel. Austin's one of those weird places. It's only like 45 minutes an hour. 45 minutes away from San Antonio,
mm-hmm.
but it's two totally different cultures. And Austin's one of those places you kind of love to visit for the day or even, for a couple of days, But, I couldn't be in Austin. I don't know if I could be an Austin person. Just because of all the, people talk about, so-called hipsters.
Yeah.
Austin is pretty, it's pretty inundated with the hipsters.
Yes, swarming. Or something.
Yeah, swarming. And I don't judge people. I don't care. It doesn't bother me. It's fine. They do have a thriving movie scene, a thriving music scene, and the food is amazing in Austin. That's kind of that's my ritual. If I ever go, every time I go to Austin, I eat at Texas Chili Parlor. That's the only place I'll eat whenever I go to Austin. So God bless Death Proof for popularizing it. I wish San Antonio was a little bit more on the map, kind of like that, but at the same time, San Antonio has kind of its own laissez-faire vibe. But at the same time, I go to New York, when I visit New It's kind of a weird thing.
Well, it just, you know, just had me, you know, you kind of was kind of answered it a bit, but just when you just mentioning how you can never be an Austin person, just how is it just being a San Antonio person, just being who you are, this film writer in San Antonio. Just I know it, when I used to live in Houston, Houston was starting to become very well known for its massive Googleplexes, I like to call them, because they were these 30-screen multiplexes that had, they usually had four theaters in the front that were the size of literally the size of arenas, and just,
right.
I don't know how it
all
is.
All the side screens were, you know, of diminishing capacity.
Mm. Yeah, just saying, and just how is it just watching movies in San Antonio?
I'm a kid of, I was born in 78, so, you know, grew up in the 80s and 90s going to movies, and so, to me, the, you know, the 14-screen plex, you know, the 14 screens, and then adding on to that, that, you know, to me, that was just a given. So, I mean, there was a time, you know, about, you know, 6-7 years ago, you know, where, you know, dropped me off at the Multiplex 24, and, you know, I would pay for a movie, go see a movie, but then I would stay and sneak around for two or three others, you know, so I could see four movies, you know, in a day, you know, that used to be, you know, now, the most I could ever do is three. Four movies in one day is, like, that's just brutal. I've done it, but the most I can do three, I usually do two. And so, but, you know, I know how to, you know, sneaking around the multiplex is, you know, kind of a rite of passage for any kid growing up in the multiplex era.
Yeah,
I was the type, I was the type to see anything. You know, I was, you know, even as a kid, I wasn't one of those early developers of a film critic. I'm like, well, I only want to see this. I only want to see these types of movies. I saw everything.
Yeah.
And I was of the mind, and I still am, that, you know, one type of film is not necessarily, better than the other. You know, just because a movie was released in the middle of the summer and had a marketing juggernaut behind it and crass, you know, product placement and all this other stuff, that doesn't mean that it can't be also a work of art. Mm. So, you know, I always, and then on the other spectrum, just because a movie is made, you know, with credit cards and is about an important subject matter and, you know, has found an audience and it's a little movie that could, you know, if I go see the movie and it's like, well, no, it's a boring piece of shit, you know, I'm not going to give it a pass just because it has quote-unquote integrity, you know. My standard line is, I think I used to say, you know, because I'm obsessed with music as much as movies, I used to say, you know, Neil Young gave integrity a bad name. That's kind of a non sequitur, but the point of that is...
I'm stealing that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I just letting you know there's going to end up somewhere that it was Neil Young, attribute that to Neil Young or something like that.
You know, and I say that, you know, and I love me some Neil Young, yeah. But, you know, I'm not one of those Neil Young fanatics where, oh, the new Neil Young album's coming out, mm-hmm. So it must, you know, so like, okay, another masterpiece. Like, no, you know, it's, you know, so, you know, love me some Neil Young, but I don't defer to Neil Young.
Yeah.
And the same thing, you know, with certain types of films, certain filmmakers, you know. So, and that's just weird. So that's one of the reasons why, well, it wasn't a guiding reason, but I knew, like, when I did my best films of 2012, which I call it a landmark year, great year, you know, I knew I would bristle some people would bristle at the fact that I put The Dark Knight Rises as the best film of the year. Because, you know, how can a movie that gigantic, that, you know, a comic book tentpole superhero movie that's a sequel extremely crafted piece of filmmaking. I know Keith would disagree with that violently, but, you know, I love Keith, so leave it.
Well, it's you know, Frank, he was mentioning about how you can't go sneak in movies like you used to. I remember I talked about this with Dennis Cottolio not too long ago, and we brought up the subject of sneaking into movies. He snuck into see three movies at a multiplex one day, and I mean it's I think most of it just like this, you know, you get, I know for me, I mean I did that in the past. I would see 3-4 movies a day, but then as you get older, you know, and plus, you know, people always just watching, you know, the various employees of multiplexes. I mean, you can't really slide into movies like you used to. I mean, I got kicked out of Jackass 3D once because I snuck in there. They said I was stealing the movie and everything. So it's just like you can't. I mean, it's a combination of those two things. Are just like you know, just you can't get away with it like you used to. And two, just you know, you're just too old to do that shit anymore. I mean, is this that kind of thing for you?
And I justify my behavior in that I misinterpret a line Roger Ebert once said that, you know, in that I feel if I buy a ticket, I consider that kind of the cover charge for the theater. So if I spent, you know, $10, you know what? I don't, you know, that means I can kind of just hang around here because, you know, and let's be honest, you know, the economics of the thing, the theater makes most of its money from the concession stand.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I buy a Coke, I'll buy a popcorn, so I'm paying for your overpriced, undercooked food. So, you know, I figure we're square. So, I don't know, that wouldn't hold up in a court of law, but that's the way I justified it in my head. But, you know, it's funny, I was talking to my sister one day, you know, she lives out in L.A., but you want to talk about price gouging at the movie tickets, you know, go to L.A. And so I was telling her, I go, well, you know that the theater doesn't make its money at the box office. And she's like, what are you talking about? I was like, no, the studio takes like 75, 80, 90% of the ticket opening weekend at the box office. So she's like, well, why, so where does the theater make its money? I go, at the concession stands. I was like, you ever wonder why a hot dog is $5 or a pretzel is $5.50 or popcorn or whatever? She's like, so that's where they make their money? I was like, yeah, they have conventions on the new products and popcorn and flavors and all that. So she asked a question that truly dumbfounded me. She's like, so if the prices of the food is so high and that's what they make their money on, she's like, why don't they make better food? And I had no answer to that. Like, she's like, why isn't the popcorn better? They're paying that much. I was like, you know, that is like the greatest question I've ever heard. Like, you'd figure for the $5 we pay for the popcorn, you know, it wouldn't cost that much. I'm sure that's not that much, but like, well, why don't they just make fresh popcorn? So, I don't know why the food isn't better, considering the prices that they charge for the shit.
Well, I must figure they're screwing you for the money. It's like, why the hell even take that extra mile to make the food better? Just like, you're gonna pay whatever for, you're gonna pay for the big bucket of popcorn. Like, why the hell just, you know, make it, you pay all this money for just all this crappy food, so what's the point? So, but, yeah. And it's just like, this low common denominator way of thinking. But, yeah,
I will say, when I go to LA, I do make it a point to go to the Arclight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because instead of a hot dog, they have the sausage baguette.
Really?
I will say it's like totally 10 times better than any processed hot dog I've ever had at theater.
Really?
I saw
a movie at the Arclight when I was in L.A. So that was a damn near hilarious experience because they, you know, I don't know if you remember, they have like they you can actually. It's like they actually treat them all the auditoriums like actual theaters, and just you can buy a seat. You know, it's not just like a first come first serve. Like you can actually buy a seat to make sure. I'm like, Jesus, like this. I went out on a Monday afternoon, so I was thinking, this is really how it is. And so I bought a seat in the back, and I go in there, and I'm literally like one of six people in there, so it's just like, so I literally had the whole back row all to myself, so I'm just like, I didn't exactly think this was, you know, I thought it was going to be a very massive experience, and just turns out just like, oh, you can just, you buy a seat, but you can still have the whole back row all to yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it comes in handy, I guess, when the new movies come out, because, like, when I was in L.A. over the New Year's break, I could never, we tried, like, three times to go see Zero Dark Thirty, always sold out.
Wow.
So, yeah, the mayor's where to buy in ahead of time, but on the other hand, when I went and saw Not Fade Away, also, like, one of the big theaters there, I had no problem finding a seat. It was kind of depressing, because I thought people should have been, that could have been selling out more than Zero Dark Thirty, or at least at the same level. But, you know, I was in the minority on that.
Well, at least you let me know about the, you know, next time I go see a movie at the ArcLight in L.A., I'll get a sausage baguette, which may be the classiest way to ever say hot dog that I ever heard. But,
Try that at the next time you're at the AMC 16. Like, what would you like? Like, I'll have the sausage baguette. They're like, excuse me? You know, a hot dog. I'm wondering, I need to look it up on Wikipedia and find out who is the jackass who said, you know, nachos in a darkened room while trying to listen to dialogue. Perfect idea. Never understood the point of nachos at a theater. I can barely understand popcorn, but I don't understand nachos.
Nachos, especially the hot dog with the foil wrapping. And just you get nothing but foil. You know, just like I it's funny when you think about this because it reminds me of the time I saw Sister Act. It was 92. I'm sitting in a theater and I'm just hearing popcorn just gnashing away, and I'm just, holy shit, this, like, who eats popcorn that loud? And that's kind of one of the reasons I sit in the back, because you don't get the surround sound masticating I'm one of these people, just like, when I go see a movie, you know, I gotta make sure that I get zero sound interference from the audience, so just like I try to maneuver myself in like the best possible seating arrangement, so I can just get because of course the speakers are in the back, you know, I get everything, so just like, yeah, so I gotta, you know, make sure I don't hear much from the crowd, which sucks, especially if you're a movie critic, and you gotta sit in those press seating areas, which are just in the middle, and you hear everything.
They have the press row, but I never sit there. I'm gonna sit up front, and it's a plus for me, because, like, if it's sold out, you know, and I come in, like, 15 minutes beforehand, and it's, like, to the Guild, they're like, where do you want? I go, I'll take the front row. And when that's full, I go, well, give them my press seats. And so, never failed. I'll always find a couple. Like, would y'all like to sit in the press row? And they jump at that shit. And so, that's how I usually get my front seat, is I give them my press row. I give away my press row seats.
Yeah.
So, weren't the wise. If you don't want to sit in the press row and you don't mind sitting up front, you know, you can give away your press row seats. Press row seats. So that's what I do. I stopped really buying concessions at the movies just because, like, the pricing. So I've realized I just get a pretzel because it's like, you know, the non-salted pretzel but is, you know, cheap and about as healthy as you're going to get at a movie theater. I did a non-salted pretzel with mustard.
I bought a bucket of popcorn once with the butter, the movie butter popcorn at a theater around here. I swear, I thought I was gonna pass out. I thought I was my blood pressure went up. It just, like, I thought I was, you know, it was like one of those things where just like, am I gonna die tonight because I had a bucket of popcorn with that motor oil butter that they have?
The best popcorn I've ever had, and I just had this last October, it's my birthday weekend, and I went and saw The Master at the Alamo Draft House in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were the only ones showing in 70mm.
Okay.
So, and the movie had been out like 3 weeks. I hadn't seen it. I purposely had not seen it. I wanted my first viewing to be in 70mm. So my birthday weekend to Alamo Draft House, 70mm showing. So I got the popcorn, and probably the best popcorn I ever ate.
Wow.
Because it was real popped popcorn with real butter. It's just unbelievable. So I'm kind of excited. Granted, it's like 2 years away that an Alamo Draft House is going to be opening up in New York, I think in Brooklyn. I think that'll be real exciting.
Maybe if I ever get back to Houston, I'll go to the Alamo Draft House over there and see if they have, so I can have the popcorn. I've probably seen all the movies that they're playing. I'll just stick in the lobby and just have the popcorn. But, this has been interesting, would you say?
Oh, yeah. I was wondering if I was going to get the call for this, because like I said, after I heard the Odie podcast of this, I was like, damn, I mean, Odie's done this, there's no way I can be on the same playing field with Odie. So I was kind of stunned when I got the email about this.
Really? Just, you would think you're not on that level to talk to me about whatever?
On the Odie level? No, I mean, And people may think I'm being snarky, but Odie is amazing. I love Odie. I love the way Odie thinks, even though he's wrong about half the time. I love the way he thinks.
Yeah, I mean, that was a great one. I mean, it's funny because, we were talking right before I was supposed to, as I believe I mentioned in the podcast, we were talking right before I had to catch a screen of Here Comes the Boom. So it's just funny, just having this conversation, this very great conversation with Odie, and it's like, I really have to end this because I got to go see a shitty ass Kevin James movie. But it was still a great time. And just listen, the name of the podcast is called Motherfuckers I Know, and hopefully it's always just getting people to be on the show and just talk about themselves and just talk about other things and talk about various things, whether it's African-American linguistics or movie popcorn. And there isn't really pass judgment on who is going to be on the show. I just like, if I can get you on the show and if you're willing to talk for an hour or so, then you're going to be a guest on the show and you have fulfilled this quite nicely.
Man, well, this is I'm on deadline as usual for Matt.
What are you doing?
Kill me.
What are you doing for him?
I'm writing. This is just a written piece on the best uses of music in the Coen Brothers movies. The best uses of music in the Coen Brothers movies.
I hope you.
He had wanted 10, and as I did a crash course of watching a good chunk of their filmography over the last 3 days, I realized I think a top 5 would be the best way to do this.
Yeah.
Just because I don't want to, and I haven't spoken to Matt, hopefully he'll agree on this, I don't want to double up, I don't want to be like, okay, here's a song from Oh Brother, and then a couple of spots down, here's another song from Oh Brother.
Yeah.
I don't want to double up on Oh Brother and Big Lebowski song music.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm working on. He approached me about this early in the week because I had done this thing like five, six years ago on uses of music in The Sopranos.
Mm-hmm.
And he really liked it. And so he's like, why don't you do the best uses of music in the Coen Brothers movies? So that's what I'm working on for this week. And so I'm inundated with all the Coen Brothers music right now, so that's all I've been like. I've had certain songs on a loop, on my part.
Yeah.
So,
it's funny you bring up Oh Brother and Lebowski, because those are the two that immediately came to mind. I'm pretty sure come to mind for a lot of other people. Like those.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously you can't not have those. But my feeling is that my ranking of these, my 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of what songs, you know, what are their best uses, is probably what will provoke the most, reaction. But, you know, kind of the thing about Coen Brothers fans, Coen heads, I guess, if you will, they're very, ferocious in their defense of all things Coen Brothers.
Yeah.
So, if you don't get it right, they're kind of like the art house equivalent of the Palma fans. You get it wrong, they really come at you. That's the way I look at the Coen. Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's any other equivalents I'm trying to think. Or Twilight heads. The art house equivalent of Twihards. I pissed off some Twilight kids one time when I wrote something, and Jesus, that was an interesting experience.
I actually was a fan of the Twilight movies. And I was an unironic fan of the Twilight series. I thought they were good, old fashioned, kind of 1950s, early 60s, Splendor in the Grass, kind of long, hot summer kind of romanticism about those films that I really responded to. And I thought they were better acted and better directed than the first Hunger Games movie, which I guess was atrocious.
Well, I mean, we could devote a whole episode to Twilight.
That's what I'm talking about,
Yeah.
Just that's what I'm talking about, There's this whole divide in critical thinking, and it's also in, fanboy thinking. That it can't be, that a Twilight movie cannot actually be a good movie, and that you can actually like a series. Yes, it is a series. It is calculated to make money. It is a product. It is, they market it to death, and it's geared toward girls who've never seen other types of movies, and all this other stuff, but you remove all of that and just look at the movies of what they are, and the Twilight movies have a real, youthful romanticism that is frankly kind of old-fashioned and absent from most cynical romantic movies that are usually snark-filled. And the thing with the Twilight movies, it also has good acting in that Kristen Stewart is a phenomenal young actress. I know she gets a bad rap for her attitude or whatever, I think she's a spectacular actress. So she anchors those movies quite well. So the Twilight movies are good. They are important. They are vital to the culture. I think it's a legitimate phenomenon, a real phenomenon, where the Hunger Games movies, the first Hunger Games movie would have made, you can argue with those numbers, obviously, or obviously you can't argue with those numbers, but I've yet to meet, where I know people who genuinely like the Twilight movies, flaws and all. I've yet to meet anyone who genuinely loves the Hunger Games movies. I took my niece to it last year. She's like, 14 at the time, 13 going on 14. And, she's like, that's a great movie. I was like, well, what'd you like about it? And, for the life of me, she couldn't articulate what she liked about it. But, that's what everyone had to see. Everyone had to see The Hunger Games. Not only did you have to see The Hunger Games, you had to see The Hunger Games 2-3 times. And you had to get the book, and you had to do this. And it was, The Hunger Games was more of a manufactured phenomenon than Twilight movies. And I seriously believe that the sequel, that's Catching Fire, is not going to do as well as the first one. As it should.
Oh man, listen. I try my best to steer away from the whole franchise movie thing because, as you just mentioned, you know, even with fans of Twilight or Hunger Games, or even the Batman Dark Knight movies, those were the most infamous in terms of fanboys, you know, just sticking their claws on critics who did, even guys like Edelstein, who would have problems with the sequels and all that stuff. It's just like, I mean, I have my opinions on it. I wish I was as open-minded as you when it came to, I mean, I saw the first Twilight, and I'm just like, Jesus Christ, they're playing baseball. What the fuck is vampires doing playing baseball? And good guy, oh god damn, it's just like one of those things where you're just like, I can't believe this happening. And just, you know, just, and so, like, I have my opinions on it. If, and, you know, you're entitled to your opinions. If you like, you think Twilight good, think Kristen Stewart is good, fine, I'm not going to get up in your ass about it. But it's just like when I put my opinions down about it, people go batshit crazy and just not even willing to listen. I mean, it's just like, and when you come across a lot of that, you just get to the point where you're just like, you know what, you just, whatever you want to say, go ahead and say it. I'm not even going to stop you because there's no way in hell I can stop you. You're going to let you get your opinion out no matter what. And just, you're not even going to listen to reason. You're not even going to, you know, you don't even care about the other person's opinion. You're not even care, definitely don't care about what I have to say because you just want to shoot it down. So it's just like, it's kind of this thing where I'm just stuck, where I just like, you know, I'm in a general state of whatever. Just what the hell ever, man.
The thing that I've learned, and it's a weird thing, I think a lot of critics are actually kind of thin-skinned in that I really don't engage comments that often, and if I do, you know, if I do engage a comment, you know, I restate, you know, I answer a claim or a charge, and if it's gonna just keep going on as a back and forth, I'm, you know, I take it like I've already answered this, so I'm just gonna let this person go on. This is why, you know, I'm on Twitter, obviously, but I really don't engage on Twitter because more than Facebook, there's a real tonal deficiency on Twitter. So I just, you know, tone is everything. So I just don't engage in comments. So I think one of the things with certain critics, you know, that, you know, they get inundated with this and that, you know, the Dark Knight and so forth. I just felt, you know, ignore the comments. That was my usual thing. Just don't even bother looking at them because, you know, you go down that rabbit hole of like, well, this person says that, and you start trying to engage and do it in a bullet point style. It's a no-win situation.
Yeah.
So, I just don't bother with comments. And usually, most of the time, I think comments are funny because when they're way off the mark, you know, there is nothing, you really can't engage. You cannot engage a commenter who is totally off the mark and off the reservation.
Yeah.
And you really shouldn't. It's like, you know, so it's like the line from LA Confidential, you know, you should leave him alone when his blood is up, you know. So I guess, you know, so luckily for me, I have yet to, I've yet to have one of those moments where anything I've written or anything I've posted has gotten the ire of a certain fanboy faction. So
you lucky bastard.
A little disappointed. I've yet to piss so many people off.
Wow.
So, and that's a certain thing. As part of being a critic, you know, there's a rite of passage when you finally get your first piece of hate mail or this, and now in this era, you know, your first, vitriol-filled comments.
Ah, man, just, well, it's funny because it's gotten to the point, you know, I have pissed off young people and old people, so it's quite an interesting experience, illuminating, if you will, just to know that you can actually piss off people on both, you know, on both ends of the age spectrum. And it's just one of those experiences that every critic must go through, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, it's just Yeah, well, I don't want to take you away from your side. I know Matt's probably gonna get in your case about that, but just tell people where they can find you online, the various spots, whether you're your blogs or you're on Twitter or Pinterest or anything.
Well, I'm on Twitter, @AaronOutItIs, on Facebook, obviously. Right now, the vast majority of my writing is for Press Play, which is blog, a part of IndieWire, so you can find all my archive stuff there, be it my Cruel Summer series, or stuff I've written on Jaws and Cape Fear, and the Steven Spielberg series that I also did a part in, so forth. So IndieWire blog, Press Play. You can also find at the Moving Image Source, which is the online magazine of the Museum of the Moving Image. All my video essays are there, and my contributions are also at The House Next Door, which is part of Slant Magazine, and the original 7-part interview series that I did with movie critics is at rockcritics.com. You can find it in its interview archives, and they were from like 04 and 05, so you can find all of those there. So, I'm an easy man to find.
Yes, you are, and just
except according to Jeffrey Wells, he couldn't find me.
Jeffrey Wells. That's one of these days. I'm just gonna figure out the appeal of both David Poland and Jeffrey Wells, and just why is I don't even know. I don't even know where to begin with that. But
I've actually spoken to Poland twice on the phone. And I give him props. He's been courteous and kind to me. So I have no beef with him. I know a lot of people do have beefs with him. And I don't think he's always right. But, he seems to have a little more working knowledge of the business, whereas opposed to the other one, twice on two separate occasions he has called me. I've never spoken to Jeffrey Wells. I've never spoken to him, and I've never exchanged an email with him. But on two separate occasions he has mocked me, ridiculed me, and demeaned me on his site. So once again, now he is the one. If I ever do meet him, I would punch. I figure I owe him that.
I'm pretty sure there's a line now for people who want to punch Jeffrey Wells, just as punch him out of his boots and his.
He actually emailed a mutual friend, demanding my contact info. He was livid about something I had said in jest on an old podcast. So he heard this, he emailed a mutual friend, went, give me his contact info, I want to email him and correct him. And this mutual friend emailed me, said, hey, Jeffrey Wells on the warpath, blah, 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 be careful. Never got the email from Jeffrey Wells. I did get called out. Instead, he just wrote a blog post about me, and how I was intimated I was on drugs or whatever and so forth. So, yeah, Jeffrey Wells, the thing that really bugged me, I didn't give a shit what Jeffrey Wells wrote about me. The thing that killed me is, like, he's emailing mutual friends, let me find his contact info. I'm, like, the easiest person to track down. I don't have any privacy, like, setting this shit, so if he wanted to find me, he could have found me. But it's just, all this indicated to me is that he's still childish. He's still a 12-year-old child and petty. And a chicken shit. So anyway, they should have Jeffrey Wells on.
Okay. All right. That's okay. That'll probably be a. That would be interesting if I can get Jeffrey Wells on this podcast. I'm pretty sure a lot of people would listen to that. You'll probably get more hits than Sean Burns' podcast or something. But we'll just see what happens in the future. But But yeah, thanks a lot, Aaron. Appreciate it. Hope you had a good time with this.
Thank you.
All right, and okay, let me just close it out here. As always, this is Craig D. Lindsay saying, you know, 1997 has good moments and has bad moments, but, you know, just like I kind of hold that year in high regard. So, you know, just keep that in mind next time I bring up 1997. Like, what the hell happened in 97? It was a good time for me. Let's just leave it at that.